and welcome to Season 14, Episode 29 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's the penultimate episode ever, and joining me for the second last time, it's Alan Pope.
Hello, Mark Johnson.
And Martin Wimpress.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the community news and events, and we're going to give some news stories from the past, while next week we'll be predicting the future. As we've mentioned before, we're wrapping up the show, but we've decided that as a bonus and a thank you to everyone for listening, we're going to have a little after party. So we'll be doing a live stream on our YouTube channel at 8 p.m. UK time on Friday, the 1st of October. That's the day after the final show is published. And there'll be a link in the show notes, and you can come along and we'll be chatting and doing some other entertaining things, hopefully, throughout the course of the evening.
Oh,
and
steady, entertaining.
So the expectations are a little high there, Mark.
Entertaining for us.
Oh, right. Okay.
Oh, okay. Fine. I'll be sipping beer.
We'll be keeping ourselves amused, and you can watch us, and you can chip in on the YouTube chat. If you'd like to come and chat with us in the meantime, or even after the show's ended, you can come along to ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. We're keeping that going. And you can tweet at Ubuntu Podcast on Twitter. So, Martin, what have you been doing in the past couple of weeks?
I've been buying iPhones.
iPhone podcast, it's coming.
Well, I think that's what we're all contractually obligated to now. Now we've all signed our exclusive agreements with Spotify to take on Applecast. Isn't that the plan? They send us a bunch of iPhones and we're going to sack off this, you know, free Linux open source nonsense for some, you know, Apple love. I thought that was the plan.
Going out with a bang there.
Oh, you didn't have to sign an NDA then?
Yes, Apple all the way.
Is this, you watched the keynote that happened last week announcing yet another round of new devices and decided I'm going to have me some of that non-free loveliness?
So I did watch that keynote, but by that point I had already purchased iPhones for my wife and daughter. So I'm currently the poor relation in the family with no iPhone. And they have both got new iPhones.
I think you're very soon going to be the poorer relation in the family once you start buying all these iPhones.
Yeah, so mine's on its way. I have ordered an iPhone 13. And my wife has an iPhone 12 mini. And my daughter has the iPhone SE.
What's been the driver for the Switch? Because I know that you've had Android phones, you've had OnePlus phones for a while, the same as I have, and I believe the same as Alan has.
Yes.
Yeah, I've been using Android phones since Android phones were a thing. I think very quickly, the reasons for me using Android don't exist anymore. iPhone does the things that they didn't used to and Android did, you know, in the past. But most importantly, Apple have made a fairly clear commitment to customer privacy that Google simply cannot make, will not make. And I'm switching for that reason, to sort of break up the efficacy with which various organizations can create your shadow profiles and sort of, you know, track your activity on the internet. So for me, mostly Apple's commitment to customer privacy. But then from my wife and daughter's point of view, it's about camera quality. My daughter's studying art and photography now, and she needs either a small camera or a smartphone with decent picture taking capabilities. And those are the two main reasons.
Alan, what have you been up to?
I've been playing with a GoTech emulator.
And what does that emulate?
It emulates floppy disk drives.
Oh my
God. Of course it does.
It's an interesting device. It's quite popular with retro. It is with retro people. It's the form factor of a floppy disk drive.
Oh, holding one up.
That you would put in an old computer, the slot that you would put a floppy drive in. But it's got a USB port on the front, and you put image files on the USB drive that you plug into it, and then use the little buttons to choose which image you want to load. And then when you go to that drive, A drive, B drive, or whatever in DOS, for example, that floppy image is presented as a floppy drive, and you can store lots of them on a USB drive that's a couple of gig in size, with each floppy being 1.4 meg or 720k. You can fit a lot of them on there, so you can flick between them without having to use the physical medium of floppy disks.
I just don't know what to say, but I will say this. Alan, Mark talked about us doing an after show on YouTube on Friday, the 1st of October. Will you please bring your GoTech emulator and point to it and point out the ports to the listeners that join us? Because I feel like they're missing out on that visual feast that you've just given to Mark and I.
You may mock, but we may. I'll allow it. In the retro computing community, they're really popular. Like, for people who use a Commodore Amiga, they put them in those. People who use IBM PCs, they put them in those. Like, people like 8-Bit Guy and Noel's Retro Lab, they use these GoTech things, because then you don't have a mechanical disk to deal with, mm-hmm. and you don't have to worry about the motor wearing out, or heads going out of alignment, or the rubber band around the motor perishing. You know, it's all digital. It's no longer mechanical.
Actually, another place I've seen these used is appliances that take floppy disks rather than PCs. So things like electric keyboards and like embroidery and sewing machines that take programs. A lot of these have been around for a long time and took floppy disks to program them.
That's exactly what it's designed for. If you go to the manufacturer's website, it doesn't mention PCs at all. It mentions sewing machines and MIDI devices and keyboards and stuff that, you know, legacy devices, shall we say, that need access to floppy disk drives for storage that people still want to use.
I look forward to the Ubuntu podcast jumper that you're working on for Mark and I for our Christmas present.
And with that, let's get on with the rest of the show. And now it's time for the community news and events. And first up in the community news this week, Alan.
Ubuntu 18.04.6 LTS has been released. And it's not necessarily a surprise, because there are point releases of LTS releases of Ubuntu on a periodic basis. But this one's slightly different, I think, because unlike previous point releases, 18.04.6 is a refresh of the AMD64 and ARM64 installer media because of the key revocation that happened with the boot hole vulnerability in secure boot enabled systems, is what it says in the post. And that's basically it. In essence, normally the point releases have new packages, just, you know, bug fixes and updates. But the problem is, with the key revocation, the old ISO images are uninstallable.
Unbootable.
Well, yes, unbootable and uninstallable. And so this is so that if you still want to use 18.04 on modern hardware with UEFI boot system and secure boot, and the keys have been revoked, you can now still install 18.04 on that new hardware.
I know we're doing our predictions for the future next episode, but I think these sort of unexpected plus point releases for Ubuntu LTS releases, because of UEFI and boot signature changes, will become more common over time. You know, it seems to be a hot ground for new vulnerabilities to be discovered that will almost certainly result in key revocation again in the future, and will require new media to be spun in order that it can be booted and installed.
It's funny, it was a decade ago, or a decade before this release, that the first time they had to re-spin the official ISOs, and that was 804 LTS, because it had the SSH key vulnerability, and that was baked onto the ISO. And they even went as far as pressing CDs for the Ship It campaign, where you could order hundreds of CDs. And I had hundreds of CDs in the boot of my car that were 804 with this SSH vulnerability. And I couldn't really, in all good conscience, give them out, because they had this SSH problem. And so they had to re-spin them and reprint a whole bunch of new physical media, which, not a problem anymore. You just upload it to the archive. Mm. But yeah. It's happened before, and like Martin says, it'll likely happen again.
Martin, what's next?
So Ubuntu 14.04 and 16.04, remember those, I can't even remember the code names, they're so old. Their life cycle has been extended to 10 years.
Trusty and Xenial, I think, aren't they?
Well done, you win.
Very long-term support release.
Yes.
Indeed. So Ubuntu 14.04 LTS is now supported via ESM until 2024. And 16.04 LTS will get security updates until 2026.
And this is actually bringing them in line with the support window for 18.04 and 20.04, isn't it? So those are already 10 years. Mm. And this is backporting that extended support to the earlier LTSs. In fact, this week I've been getting notifications from my Microsoft Azure hosted build agents, which are running Ubuntu 16.04, saying, we're dropping support for this soon. I wonder if this is going to affect that or if they're going to still retire those old VMs.
Well, I imagine so, because otherwise they're going to have to sign up for ESM for all of the build machines and, you know, get security updates via ESM.
That's all right, because Canonical are a super
good friends,
gold Microsoft partner now, aren't they?
So I hear, yeah.
Yeah, so I think this works a bit differently. I think it's down to the cloud partners to actually opt into Ubuntu Pro in order to pass that cost down to people using those images. So if you're not using an Ubuntu Pro image, which includes ESM, then, yeah, they may disappear from beneath you. But Ubuntu Pro, if you're using those images, then they get all of this good stuff baked in.
It does make you wonder how many of these 14.04 and 16.04 machines there are out there. There was one fairly prominent person in Canonical who refuse to upgrade, and she would keep her 16.04 system on Unity for a very long time, and she resisted moving off of the Unity desktop and just kept her 16.04 system. I think snaps are invented for her.
Well, you might remember that 12.04 went through this ESM, you know, process some time ago. And as I understand it, it was a single customer that was delivered for. So there is somebody significant out there with a lot of Ubuntu who wanted to stay on 12.04 very, 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 very much.
They threw a large bag of money at Canonical. So please don't make it go away. Excellent.
And finally, in completely non-controversial news, which won't matter to anyone, Ubuntu is switching the default Firefox install from Deb to Snap.
What? Outrage! Etc.
Yes. So this was announced by Ken Van Dyne from the desktop team. I can't remember what it is, like a code freeze exception. Is that what it was called? Feature freeze exception.
FFE.
So this will be in the next release of Ubuntu vanilla flavor, and in the next LTS of all of the other flavors, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Assuming all goes well.
Yes. From what I hear, there were conversations, between Canonical and Mozilla, and depending upon whose post you read, it seems unclear whether this is a Canonical-driven thing or a Mozilla-driven thing. But the net result is the Deb of Firefox, a default application, will now be replaced with the Snap of Firefox, which makes it easier for Canonical / Mozilla / whoever to keep that Snap up to date by pushing a new version to the Snap Store and updating all those machines out in the wild, rather than waiting for someone to have to build a deb of it and then upload it to the archive and go through the process in the archive, which is a lot slower.
Yeah, this initiative was absolutely driven by Mozilla. You know, they contacted Canonical over a year and a half ago around this issue. So, and I was involved in some of those initial conversations. But, you know, it serves their interests well. What's interesting about this is that Mozilla have distribution rights for Firefox. So in order to ship Firefox as Firefox with modifications made to it, like, for example, the default start page, you'll know that Ubuntu has a branded start page, then you have to apply for distribution rights to Mozilla. And there is a contract in place to support all of that. And that contract was up for renewal. And Mozilla saw an opportunity to streamline the way they can deliver Firefox to Ubuntu users. And that was the start of that conversation.
That's really interesting. I mean, one of the things that I quite like about this is that, you know, we've had discussions before and we've had feedback in, you know, to the show and in our Telegram channel about snaps, and particular desktop snaps, you know, being slow to start and having other problems integrating. And, you know, I spoke a while ago about how when I first tried the Firefox snap, I stopped using it because of the integration points weren't what they ought to be. And I think it's a really good move to do this with something, not just a default installed application, but the web browser, perhaps the most used default installed application, because it gives all of these things absolutely nowhere to hide in the QA process. All of these things now absolutely have to work. There's no getting away from that.
And what I would encourage the peanut gallery on the internet to do is not just tweet and make YouTube videos about how this all sucks and is terrible, but speak to the developers, go to the bug tracker, raise the profile of the bugs that are already existing by marking them with the Me Too button at the top. And if you know other people who are affected by these bugs, get them to go and Me Too the bugs. Describe the problem articulately in a friendly and respectful way on the bug tracker, because that's the way to get the developers' attention. Tweeting and YouTubing and arguing on forums about this being the worst thing in the world and it's terrible because ... actually won't fix anything. The best thing to do is to talk to the people who are doing this packaging, which is Mozilla and Canonical, directly to the developers on the bug tracker, and that will get you way faster fixes. Not saying they'll be fixed, but way faster than just shouting into the void.
Yeah, and I would add to that, you know, it's kind of circulating as internet law that snaps are slow. And I think a lot of people jump to cause as soon as they see snaps discussed, they'll say, well, snaps are slow. That is a fact. That is what everyone says. I noticed a couple of people actually took the initiative in the OMG comments to go away and test the Firefox snap and reported, actually, this is not slow. At all.
Well, it's slower than the Deb.
It was slower for the for cold start,
yes.
But they noticed that, you know, once it's up and running and the caches have been warmed up, it's all fine. And it will improve, but don't just repeat what you've heard without experiencing it for yourself. And as Alan says, when you have experienced it for yourself, report any shortcomings in a meaningful way so that they can be addressed.
And a couple of things we've seen in this space, I think, in the past couple of weeks are developments around the Spotify and Slack snaps, which are two snaps which have had issues and have been vastly improved by a bit of focus and development effort from, I think, with some help from Canonical and some work from the developers themselves to, you know, put in place improvements. So, you know, these problems can be fixed and hopefully will be smoothed out even more as we approach the next LTS.
Yeah, I wish them good luck with that. I really do, in a non-cynical way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not, startup speed is just one problem. There are plenty of other issues. The confinement plays havoc with expectations that the software has. And there are some, you know, a browser is such a universal thing, piece of software. You know, for some people, it's pretty much the only application they have open all day, every day. And there are certain use cases, whether it's authentication with some kind of token or additional extensions that monkey around with the behavior of the browser, that could also be, in inverted commas, broken by the migration from Deb to Snap. And you need to test this stuff out and report it, because around the corner next year is LTS time. At 2204, all the flavors are going to get this. And the Deb, I suspect, will be removed from the archive and replaced with a shell script that basically does Snap install Firefox. And so if you want it to be the best thing possible, then contribute and let people know all the little broken, sharp edges. Let Ken and the rest of the desktop team know, and they'll prioritize and fix accordingly.
And finally, we have an event. It's UbuCon Asia 2021. It's happening on September the 25th and 26th, and it is going to be fully online. So you can go to 2021.ubucon.asia and find out more. Now it's time for some of our favourite news stories that we've covered in the show over the past 14 years. And first up, Martin.
My favourite story from the past was when we covered a YouTuber, Jim Sterling, figuring out a workaround to YouTube's content ID system, which he called the content deadlock or copyright deadlock.
This was neat. I remember watching this and thinking, ha.
I think in that episode, this was an episode we recorded. It was season 9, episode 11 that we recorded on the 12th of May, 2016. And I think in that episode, I said this was 21st century genius. And the way that the copyright deadlock worked is that you deliberately lace your YouTube videos with copyright works from multiple parties, and then none of them can actually claim ownership over your video because none of those copyright claims can be resolved because they're all from different organizations.
So this was 5 years ago. Has anything changed since then? Does he still do this, and is it still effective?
Sadly not.
Oh.
As of late 2020, the copyright deadlock no longer works. And Jim has said as much, he's now looking at other techniques. Now, the important thing to know about this is that Jim doesn't use monetization on YouTube to support his channel at all. He's entirely supported through Patreon, and he has no monetization on his videos because he doesn't want videos being rolled at the beginning and the end of his videos to destroy what he sees as, an artistic expression and, a bit of journalism.
Journalism interspersed with latex-clad wrestling and other strange activities.
Well... yes, I was going to say, we do have a link to this original episode where he explains how the copyright deadlock works. Not one to watch at work or or in a family setting. Let's just say that.
Got it. he
does have a confrontational style of delivery, both in terms of language and visuals. But nevertheless, it was an ingenious way to work around this system. He was basically saying, I'm not looking to monetize my work on YouTube, and I'm going to try and stop everyone else from doing so. And in fact, when we recorded that episode, Laura was still on the show. And Laura suggested that, erasure videos, it could be used in your videos to create a deadlock in and also resurface a popular artist from the past. Well, Jim must have been listening because Erasure has indeed been a frequent artist that he's used in videos in the intervening years in order to deliberately trigger the copyright deadlock.
Nice.
So we can all dance to Chains of Love at this point.
Excellent. Alan, what story did you dig out of the archives?
I actually went back and listened to what I think is one of my favourite episodes that we've ever done. And I say we, neither of you were in it.
Is that what makes it so good?
Absolutely.
Wow.
It was myself,
wow.
Tony, Simon and Davey presenting season 1, episode 11. And in that episode, there's a few things that I liked about it. We used to have what we called sarcastic news, which was just like a headline and then one of us making a cheeky comment about the news. And I'd completely forgotten we did that. Listening to that episode, it's very long. It's over an hour long. And the news has got a bed of music underneath it, our normal bed. But there's like a news headline and then an ascorbic comment and then moves on to the next one.
There's no more information.
There's no discussion whatsoever. It's hilarious. I love it. And in that episode, we also had an interview with the OpenStreetMap developers, two OpenStreetMap developers, and we recorded that at Lug Radio Live in Wolverhampton. And the reason why I love it is because it dates back to 2008, and in it, they talk about how little of the Earth is mapped with OpenStreetMap, and they talk about the goals of the project and how you get involved and all that kind of stuff. But I was reminded that they had this aspiration that maybe by the end of the year, they might have all of the UK mapped. And I just think about how OpenStreetMap, you can scroll around the entire planet and it's basically all mapped. And like the questions, you know, we were asking about getting involved and stuff, but also, well, what do you do once you've mapped the Earth? And they suggest, well, you could put pubs and shops and post boxes. Do you know where your nearest post box is? And
take a photo of a dentist and upload it.
Right. And it delighted me that we had this little snapshot of an interview with these people who worked on OpenStreetMap right back at the start. And I remember looking at the map of OpenStreetMap as it was then, and there were giant blank spaces with maybe one road that someone had plotted with a GPS. And one comment that was said in that episode, in the interview, that made me smile was one of the OpenStreetMap guys said, this phone here, this is a modern phone. This has got GPS in it. All phones in the future will have GPS. And I thought, oh my God, there used to be a day when phones didn't have GPS. And it blew my mind that we've got this little snapshot of the past in that episode, and I love it.
So what was the last dog camp we were at? Was it 2018 or 2019 in Sheffield? Whichever year it was, we were there, and the OpenStreetMap guys did a presentation. Their call to action wasn't, let's map whole countries that don't have maps. It was all about refining very tiny details and accuracy in the maps that existed. And it was literally like, you know, meters of accuracy on building shapes and things of that nature. And the way they developed tools in order to make it easier to do those kind of low level corrections. So they've clearly come a long way in the intervening 10 years in that it's now about the details, not about the broad strokes.
And isn't there an app you can get now? I can't remember what it's called, but it's for doing these sort of
Street Complete.
There we go. For doing like tiny little updates as you're walking along.
And there's one other thing, notable thing about that episode that I have to mention. We gave away a Shuttle PC. We had started a competition in a previous episode and we gave away this efficient PC called a Wraith. And it was one of those small shuttle shaped computers. And we also kicked off a new competition. There was like loads of competitions back then. And it was to give away a Viglin MPCL, which was a tiny little AMD Geode powered computer. And I will always remember corpsing in a later episode when we had to read out the answers in the question. The question we gave to win this thing was, what would you do with a Viglin MPC-L? And someone from the Surrey Linux user group called John Washington wrote in and said if he won the Viglin MPCL, he would put it in his wife's lobby area. And I don't know why, but at that point, when he said his wife's lobby area, I cracked up and I couldn't complete that bit. And they had to mute my microphone. And I think Laura had to read it out in the end. So if you... Anyway, that is one of my favorite episodes that we ever did. And actually, I think it's one of the most popular ones of that season because there was the opportunity to win that computer. And a lot of people listened to it. And it was linked to from a lot of places because people wanted to listen in and win that Viglin.
Yeah. So what year was this? Was this 2008?
Eight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many years later in 2012, I was still using the voucher code published on the Ubuntu podcast website in order to get a discount on a Viglin MPCL order. We were using them as DHCP servers at work. That's all we were using them for.
I very recently, as in within the last few months, dug one out because Andy Stanford Clark, the UK CTO of IBM, who has given talks at OddCamp, still uses them himself. And he DM'd me on Twitter and said, one of them has failed. Is there any chance you've got a spare Viglin that I can have? I'm like, yeah, yeah, totally. So I packaged it all up and posted it over to the Isle of Wight. And so my very last Viglin has gone off to Andy Stanford Clark, which I think is a fitting home for it. What about you, Mark? What's your favourite news article from the past?
Well, it's a story that came up a few times around, I think the reason that it sticks in my brain is because it was around the time that I started doing the podcast. It was around sort of 2009, 2010 that we did quite a few stories about this. And this was Google Wave. So Wave was announced at the time as basically a replacement for email. And it wasn't just because, you know, Google are launching this new service and everyone can sign up for Google and use it. It was because it was going to be an open federated protocol that, you know, not just you know, you install Google's Wave server in your organization, but people could write their own Wave servers, and people on one Wave server could send messages to someone on another Wave server.
I completely forgot that it was federated. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So Novell, I think, are the only other company I knew of who had an alternative implementation, which was called Novell Pulse. But I don't think that ever actually got off the ground, because by the time they would have launched it...
Flatlined.
Google... By the time they would have launched it, Google had actually killed Wave, I think. But at the time, it was amazing, because you saw things like, you know, people would open a document in their web browser and start a conversation with someone, and then they'd be typing, and you'd see what they were typing come up in real time for the other person, and it would be doing things like autocorrect in real time. And, you know, rather than what people were used to at the time, which is you spend ages writing an email and send it, and it gets sent, and then they download it, and then they could see it. And I remember, you know, watching keynotes with people being wowed by all of this, which is now just completely passé to us these days.
I can only imagine Google killed this so very, very swiftly, because the only thing I remember about Google Wave is that it was killed. I never got to use it or try it out. It was dead before I even realized it was a thing.
I think it was a technology looking for a problem. It was a solution looking for a problem. I don't think there really was a bunch of problems solved with it. There were lots of cool technologies that were in Wave that were then repurposed in other things, like in Etherpad and Google Docs, and, you know, the chat thing in Google Docs is, you know, very
exactly.
similar
I think,
to features.
I think that's the thing, is Wave's ideas live on in other products and, you know, have been copied in other products. Yeah, things like Google Docs, Office 365 are the really obvious ones that you can see have just sort of picked up those features and kept them going, which is why these days you look at Wave and you think, so what? But yes, the other thing, of course, is that it wasn't killed. It was donated to the Apache Software Foundation, where it became Apache Wave. Remember? No?
And then died.
Yeah, and then died, yes.
Right next to OpenOffice.
Exactly. Software doesn't go, it doesn't die. It gets donated to the Apache Software Foundation. And that is all the news for this week, last week, and the past 14 years. And that is all for episode 29. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next time for the final episode ever